Whether it's slots or live dealers, SpinQuest.com has the fun and action you're looking for with SpinQuest exclusives, blackjack, roulette, baccarat, and even live dice with craps and bubble craps. The games never stop, so you don't have to. And right now, new users get $30 coin packs for just $10. Play now at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Save big money on everything you need at Menards. Your roof is the first line of defense against the elements, and it enhances the appearance of your home's exterior. Owens Corning shingles offer ultimate protection and impressive curb appeal. Choose from 26 colors of Owens Corning Duration shingles and transform your home today. Shop our selection of roofing products on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer and find plenty of great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Trigger warning, this episode includes detailed discussion of gun violence, school shootings, suicide, disturbing writings, and hate speech. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
We're back.
Yay, we're back. We're back. We're back.
We're back. We're back. We're back.
We're back.
We're back. We're here. We're back and we're back.
Welcome back to Macabre Mondays, where mystery meets the macabre with your favorite Deadly Mary duo. I'm Ale.
And I'm Tom.
Your guides through the strange, the sinister, and the spooky, where I tell the stories and he gets dragged along for the ride. We're back, baby. We're back and we're better than ever. Yes. Thank you, everyone, for the very well wishes. That was rough, okay? For all those of you who did not know, the reason why we did not record an episode or release an episode last week was because I had the Rona.
Ale was dying.
Yes. Seriously, it was so painful. It's like the new, it's that new strain.
It's the new strain.
Yeah.
And it messed you up.
My throat, I have never been that sick where my throat, I still feel like my throat isn't 100% how it normally is for some reason, but I think that just might be me. But yeah, that messed me up. That hurted so bad. So bad. But I still can't also even believe thinking about it now that we even went through a whole pandemic. But I mean, that's a story for another day. So thank you guys, everybody, for telling me, you know, get well soon and a speedy recovery, because speed did recover. So we do good now. Anyways.
Okay.
Today's episode. Now, usually I ask you, where do you think we're going? Where are we traveling to, et cetera, et cetera. No, today I'm going to go ahead and just tell you what we're doing, what episode we're covering, because you most likely already know this case. I'm probably 90% sure you do, because anyone born in the 90s or 80s knows about this story.
The Columbine.
Yes, that's exactly.
Get the fuck out.
That's what I mean. Yo. That's why I'm like, why am I even going to bother asking him? I think he's going to know. Yes.
I know, joke. I was just kind of thinking, initially, the only other thing that I feel like happened that was major for 90s kids was 9/11.
9/11. Yes. Yes.
So, and S2K. So.
S2K.
Was it S2K or two? You know what I'm talking about. When we were hitting the end of 1999 and everyone was freaking out and they were like, turn your devices off. Everyone turn all your computers off. Turn your power off.
I didn't know this.
You don't remember this?
No.
Yeah,
is it called S2K?
I want to say it was S2K. Hold on.
Okay, now you have to look it up because...
No, not S2K, actually. It was Y2K. And it was a widespread computer flaw where systems using a two-digit year like 99... for 1999 might misinterpret the year 2000 as 1900.
Wow.
So,
that's what Google said? Wow.
Yes. Okay. It was also known as like the Millennium Bug, because so many people were just freaking out thinking that their systems were going to crash and everything. Nobody knew how these computers, because compared to what we have today, nobody knew how their computers were going to react to.
Oh, so that's what kind of caused the hysteria behind it? Wow, that's very interesting.
There was
a
lot of other conspiracy theories around it too, but
plus that was also the day and age when, I mean, Google was founded in 97, was it?
I think it was 98.
Okay.
They came up with the idea, and it was originally called alphabet.com.
So imagine that. First off, we are like the first generation that yes. are just getting ahead with this social media, internet, Wi-Fi, all the computers, the high tech and all that. So imagine at that day and age, the type of conspiracy theories literally. That were going around. Yeah, that's crazy. Well, I'm so glad that you caught it off the bat because I was like, this is going to be such a dark, deep, heavy episode, everybody. So I'm just going to tell you, trigger warning from here on out, like this whole episode is just going to be...
This is wild because be no joke, I think the last time I ever remember reading and researching this case mm-hmm. was in middle school because we actually had a survivor that came and talked to us.
No way. Mm-hmm. Wow.
It was one of the girls that had survived, and I want to say she had also been hit.
Uh-huh.
But I can't remember for sure. I just remember it was in middle school and... Obviously, that was so long ago, but yeah. I remember we had to do research papers and
right.
really learn about it. And everyone knew what it was, but then doing the research and actually learning right. more. But that was the last time. And yeah. I don't remember a lot of it.
Well, it's crazy because every year I think about it, especially it happened in April, okay, the 20th. And I particularly always remember it too because my sister's birthday, my older sister, her birthday is on the 19th. So for some reason, it was just something that stuck with me. I think it was a thing yeah. when I was a kid that I, like, if I knew people's age, people's birthday years or their dates, I'm like, oh, that happened near that or what happened there. I don't know why. That's just like a thing of how yeah. I've measured a specific time. So I always thought about Columbine. And so every year I still do for some, I mean, growing up, it was such a heavy.
It was a huge thing. Yes,
and it's wild because there were a lot of other school shootings before Columbine, obviously, but this one was, I think it was either considered one of like a big, what's mass shooting?
It was a mass yes. shooting, yes.
And it was to the magnitude that it was, because I'm going to get into the details and the nitty gritty of stuff. And hopefully, I mean, I try to research every case and story that we cover to the best of my ability. I'm only one person. So that's why I always reach out. I always let everybody know, hey, listen, if there's something we missed, let us know, because every case is so dynamic and it's got its own, obviously its own story. There's so much sadness and grief to a lot of the cases that we cover. So I try to do my best to be respectful and cover everything that we possibly can. And this one is one of those specifically because of the magnitude of people that it affected. The victims, the survivors, just people who went to the school, just people who lived in the area. So just moving forward, just big trigger warning. I was crying my eyes out researching this deeply on and off. I know Tom could definitely attest to that.
Yes.
And it's just very heart-wrenching. It's just very heart-wrenching. And then when it comes to schools and kids, oh, it's just hard. So how much do you remember of it? Because when you researched it in school, was mm-hmm. there anything? Yeah, like just give me some topics.
Well, one, we had a girl that came to talk to us.
Right. Which again, incredible. Wow.
Don't remember her name.
Yeah.
Don't remember who she was. But she came and talked to us. I remember it was two gunmen, I believe.
Right.
And I don't want to give too much away either because yeah, I want everyone to yeah. listen in. But I just remember, roughly... And not perfectly sequenced. I just remember kind of where they started. I remember watching some of the footage mm-hmm. of the shooting.
Yeah.
And then I remember seeing a lot of the videos from the aftermath as well of like outside of the school looked. And everything. And I think that is, for the most part, that's the most that I really remember.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
More
yes.
of that high level.
Right.
Broader.
Just, yeah, what yeah. a lot of people remember. Right. And the reason why I wanted to cover this one was... specifically, I mean, what a big piece of dark history in our world. But also we were getting submissions from listeners that wanted us to cover it,
really?
Wanted me to cover it. Yes. And we are going to go today to Littleton, Colorado. Did you remember that it was in Colorado by chance?
I knew it was in Colorado.
In Colorado. Okay. Yeah.
Part of me wanted to say that. And then I also was thinking you might be wrong. Don't say shit. Just keep
well,
your
you
mouth
never
shut.
Know. No, you never know. Well, I'm going to start going into pretty much talking about the gunmen and just kind of leading us right into today's story. So, again, I will mention it, trigger warning. this is going to be a very heavy case. We're going to be touching a lot of different topics: gun violence, school shootings, suicide, disturbing writings, hate speech. Listener discretion is strongly advised moving forward, okay? I know you mentioned the two gunmen. So one of them was Eric Harris. He was born in Wichita, Kansas in 1981. His dad was an Air Force pilot, so the family moved around a lot until they eventually landed in Littleton, Colorado in the early 90s. In 1999, when this tragic event, the mass shooting, took place, Eric was 18 years old. Now, at first glance, Eric looked like your average teenage kid. He played soccer, he was smart, he was quick-witted, he was good with computers, he had friends, he had a job, and even...
He was living a typical high school
life. Typical high school life, yeah, typical teenager. He even had this polite smile whenever he needed it, so... Because the thing is, behind closed doors, and especially online, Eric was writing things that were deeply, deeply disturbing. Under the username Reb, and later Rebdomen is what I was reading, he would post rants on his personal website about how much he hated people, how he fantasized about violence, how he was building bombs, and how he wanted to kill. And I was reading, it's all publicly out there, but the FBI vaults, like, they actually have all the files on there. Yes, online. Yeah, so it's public. Certain things, obviously, they don't, and we'll get into that. But on there, you can read a lot of the logs, because he kind of had this website where he's just blogging. Like, he's blogging about his life. He's blogging about how much he hates this and that, and I'm going to talk more about that. Now, when I say the type of writings that he's adding in these blogs, he was logging the names and the explosive tests of pipe bombs that he was building. So some of the, and he even named them.
Damn.
Yes, he even named them. So some of his pipe bombs, one of them was called Pezzy, one of them was called Atlanta.
Oh my gosh.
One of them
was
called...
This is giving me like World War II nuclear vibes.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. And each one of them, he even wrote down their measurements, their powder load, how well it blew up, and how proud of them he was. And it kind of didn't stop there, because he would actually write about people he wanted dead. About classmates that he felt maybe would have rejected by him, that he felt rejected by, or one post, he actually named a specific person, which is a former friend of his. Yes. And he says, "All I want to do is kill and injure as many of you pricks as I can, especially a few people like Brooks Brown."
Holy shit.
Now, I'm going to talk about Brooks Brown in a bit, but in another passage or paragraph that he writes in his blog, he says, "I am the law. If I don't like you, you die." And then the line that would become the most prominent, I guess, would be to define his mindset at the time, was "dead people don't argue."
Damn, it almost comes across like a god persona
kind of thing. Yeah. Which it's crazy, because he really hated structure. He hated society. He worshipped control. He worshipped violence and what he called, well, not what he called, because I think that it is what it's called now, but he really worshipped natural selection, which he had actually referenced a lot in his writings. But how much like, oh, he loves natural selection, because he would literally be like, oh, dumb people, this. Like, he even stated certain things of, like, you know what I really hate? There's this one blog entry that he did, and he's like, "You know what I really hate is people who love Star Wars. Like, get a fucking life, like all this."
I like Star Wars.
I know. But he would say stuff like that, or like people that drive slow, or just people that walk too slow, or how people pronounce certain things. Like, he just hated the world. He hated everything around him. He loved certain things, like, oh, I love school, I love freedom of speech. So it was just really crazy, because what's even more chilling is how well he was masking it. So on the outside, he was just this regular kid with like an attitude, nothing crazy. But on the inside, he's plotting a mass murder that we come to know later.
Which is absolutely wild. One, two things that are crazy about it. One, the way he's talking about this.
Yeah.
But two, to me, somebody at his age knowing how to develop and prototype bombs.
Right.
To be able to figure out how much powder.
Right.
that is a level of science that
that's
next level.
And dedication. Yes,
you can learn in chemistry how to blow stuff up and everything. That,
right.
Obviously. But learning it at that level of how to use a pipe bomb, how to do stuff like that and remote detonation and all that, right. That's wild.
And then having the thought process already that you hate the world, that you want to kill specific people, you want to kill all of them, like you're fantasizing, you're ideating about murder. It's insane. So obviously that doesn't go hand in hand, which is crazy because I learned a lot about, especially right now, like while I was researching and doing my own deep dive on it, was so many things that I didn't know before, which I'm obviously going to get into it, but it just really painted a picture that I didn't know. Like I just thought two gunmen who were from the school, they came, they shot the school up. And people, like so many students died, and then from that's it. But I didn't know a lot of the deep issues with it.
Based off what I remember too, him and the other shooter more or less kind of give me Slenderman stabbing vibes.
Okay, yeah.
With how the
they
two
feel
girls.
Like they kind of worship. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which you'll see.
But
you'll
in a different way.
Yeah, because Eric has this fascination and he's like worshiping control and he likes violence. But Dylan, on the other hand, which is our second shooter, Dylan Klebold, he was different. He was born in Colorado that same year, 1981, and came from a very loving, educated, stable home. His parents were engaged and very attentive with him growing up. He was soft-spoken. He was creative. But in his journals, Dylan was pouring out a lot of deep sadness. And in 1999, the year that this took place, Dylan was 17 years old.
Mm-hmm.
He, in his journals, he was writing about feelings like he felt like he was a ghost, like he didn't belong, like he didn't matter. He wasn't just angry, but he was very depressed and very suicidal. So in this instance, Eric rages outward and Dylan seems to rage inward. So when the two of them become friends sometime during middle school,
it was almost like a balance for both.
A balance
that,
but that
led to feeding off of each other.
Exactly. And together they ended up building this world where, oh, you hate people? Well, I hate my life. And it's like, you understand me in a way that no one else understands me and vice versa. Now, there were early red flags early on, which this is what I was learning, which I thought was crazy, but they weren't totally invisible. In January of 1998, so over a year before the shooting took place, Eric and Dylan were actually arrested for breaking into a van and stealing electronics.
Get the fuck out.
Yeah. And they were actually caught and charged, and they were, essentially forced to enter a juvenile diversion program because they were caught stealing, you know, and they have those protocols.
Yeah, especially at that age.
Right. Now, they went to counseling and they wrote apology letters. Eric's looked especially thoughtful and almost a bit too thoughtful because in his private journal, he actually ends up writing about him laughing at the fact that he had to say all those things, that he was just lying about it and he was just trying to trick everybody. He was just trying to get out of that. So as you can see,
so he's got a persona already.
Yes.
To this.
And around this same time, friends actually started noticing a shift with them. One student in particular, Chris Morris, he actually had worked with both of the boys at a local pizza shop, and he'd once been close with them, but said that they had started acting kind of off and that they were skipping class a lot more and kind of pulling away from everybody else and just being with themselves.
Which already should be a huge red flag.
Yeah, but again, the thing that sucks about this is because we know what we know now, obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this is also back in 1990.
Right. And it's like, oh, it's probably just teenagers being teenagers.
Yes.
Because even friends around him were like, and that's the thing, that as we keep getting forward and we go further into the story, there was those type of red flags. Like, oh yeah, they were acting very off, but everyone said, like, no one thought anything of their behavior in the sense of where this led.
Yeah. Because again, not to say it, but I feel like there were a lot of kids at that time that just kind of were off. Like it was just, it was normal. It was the 90s. Everyone had you had your emo phase and everything. So
everybody had cliques.
Yeah.
I'm sure this still is now.
Exactly.
Right. But knowing from what we knew back then, it was, no.
Now you get paid a little bit more attention to, and it's
right.
Oh, this behavior is a little off.
Right.
We should work on focusing on this person. But back at this time, that wasn't really a thing.
And that's a good point to mention, because I feel that we have experienced so, unfortunately, experienced so many school shootings, mass shootings in general, just, I mean, that it really just has everybody on edge now. So when you are acting kind of strange at times, that might be, you know, people are kind of now being like, oh, watch out. You never know what's going on. So yes, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
So on the morning of April 20th of 1999, the day that this tragic event took place, Chris Morris, his friend, saw something that stayed with him since. He was leaving the school to go home for lunch, something that he says that he did very often. And when he was leaving, he saw Eric walking towards the high school from the junior parking lot. And Eric was carrying a very small, well, I don't know if it was very small, but it was a small duffel bag. The direction that he was coming from was strange, Chris said, because it just didn't feel right. But Chris thought, okay, well, that's just weird. And he just didn't say anything. And he ended up going home to eat lunch. Okay. Again, I mean, okay, he's just coming back from the junior parking lot, I wouldn't think.
But I mean, I would have been like, okay.
Strange, but they're already acting weird. Yeah, they've already been acting weird for months. Yeah. It's like, well, I guess Dylan's just being Dylan.
Dylan's just being Dylan, yeah. Dylan,
yeah, I mean, Eric's just being Eric, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, he ended up going home, he ate lunch, but when he came back, the school was surrounded by police tape. Because right when he left,
is when it started happening.
That's when they were coming to start.
Damn.
Later, Chris ends up telling the FBI everything that he knew, that, you know, he had seen bombs that they were creating, that he had seen videos of Eric and Dylan showing off their guns, that he had watched them test the explosives in the wood and in their backyards. And he hadn't spoken up about it before because he was scared that he'd get blamed. You know, like, oh, that wasn't me. That was him. He had the bombs. He whatever, all that stuff. But he wasn't alone, because other classmates would also say that they had seen these type of warning signs, but didn't know that, you know, no one's gonna know in that moment what you're looking at. Sure, is it strange?
Again, it was strange, but it wasn't out of the ordinary to where,
and
back then, it probably was more looked at as like,
that's what they're
weird,
doing.
But I mean, everyone has a hobby, I guess.
Right. And the thing that I was thinking is that me and you obviously grow very differently. You grow in the Midwest, and that was kind of, I mean, not that you guys are making pipe bombs, but you know what I mean? That you guys are in the backyard, like shooting guns.
Yep.
Just playing, like, oh, let's, like, doing dumb shit, because
we grew up playing with airsoft guns. And I think I told you, I said, we used to have airsoft battles throughout the neighborhood. Right. I'm sure we definitely, apologies to all the, homeowners at that time that had cars that unfortunately possibly have small dents from our airsoft battles. But we used to have airsoft battles throughout the whole neighborhood. Cops never got called on us. Parents would occasionally just check in and say, come out. Even parents that didn't, or adults that didn't have kids, they would come out, hey, would you mind just being cautious? I don't want that hitting our window or whatever. But they just let us be kids.
Yeah.
That was just part of the culture of that area.
And that's the thing. Like, to me, the gun situation of them testing out guns, because there's also, have you ever heard of the basement tapes?
No.
Okay. I'm going to get into that as well, because there are some basement tapes that Eric and Dylan made prior to the mass shooting. Yes. And to me, I mean, again, it's harder for me to understand because I didn't grow up in the Midwest. Not saying that that's a normal hobby of some sort. I don't know. But like I said, you're in the backyard, you guys are shooting guns. Like, I guess that's a, like you said, that's just kind of a thing you guys used to do. Yeah. When I hear pipe bombs, I'm like, okay, that seems very alarming to me, because why in the world would you need to make a pipe bomb?
Also, to be fair though, even, I don't know many kids, even kid friends that I had that their parents were in the military, I don't know many of them that were shooting guns on their own. It was always, oh, I went and shot guns, or I went hunting with my dad or with my uncle, or it was always with an adult.
Somebody,
it was never, my parents know that I go and shoot guns on my own. That was never actually a thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally get it. And there's just so much. Now, remember how I mentioned Brooks Brown? How?
Yes.
Okay. Eric said that he'd want to kill somebody like Brooks. They were friends before, because Brooks and Eric actually started as friends when they were freshmen at Columbine High School. They hung out in the same circles, but by late 1997, their friendship kind of unraveled. Brooks recalled it kind of starting over with what seemed something really small, a school project of some sort where Eric refused to help and kind of blew him off. So it was like little things like that. But Brooks ended up confronting him. And after that, Eric began openly targeting him with a lot of hostility that just kind of felt very out of proportion.
Mm-hmm.
Like he was very angry towards Brooks. And it's like, you're angry over that? Like, why are you so mad
over that?
Yes. Now that tension was escalating when Brooks' parents actually discovered Eric's personal website. And remember how I said he was ranting about,
yeah,
it's his personal blog. It's like his Tumblr, yeah, right? It wasn't just teenage ranting. It actually was containing a lot of explicit death threats against Brooks.
Damn.
And he even wrote plans to blow up the Browns family home and step-by-step description of how Eric was going to build the pipe bomb.
That's
for
wild.
It.
Wild.
Yes. Now, Brooks's mom, Judy, remembered that the moment she first read that site, I read an article that she said it was like staring into the mind of someone you thought you knew and finding a stranger who wanted to kill your son, which that is insane.
Yeah, because you... I don't know.
That's a hell of a threat. That's in, like, you're not talking, I'm going to beat him up. You're talking, I'm going to blow your freaking house up.
That's fucking disgusting and just
disturbing.
That's terrifying.
Yes. The Browns, they actually printed those pages and took them straight to Jefferson County Sheriff's Office in early 1998. And when the deputy opened the file, he collected the evidence and he even drafted up an affidavit for a search warrant of the Harris home.
Really?
But there were really no reasons fully ever explained. The warrant was never executed and the investigation went cold.
Damn, that's wild.
So who's to say that most likely,
yeah,
if they did end
definitely
up searching,
found at least something.
They would have probably found a lot. And on top of that, who knows if Columbine would have happened?
Yeah.
But again,
that's wild.
There's just a lot.
There's a lot of what ifs.
Yeah, what ifs for sure. Now, years later, the affidavit actually surfaced publicly, showing that law enforcement had been kind of pretty much a step away from entering Eric's home a full year before Columbine. And at this point, he already had made explosives, so they would have been like, we're gonna have to take you in. You're not even supposed to be. I think it's illegal. It's illegal, isn't it?
I would think. I have no idea.
I don't know. If anybody knows, let me know. But it just kind of, like I said, becomes an example of like, shit, if we had really followed through with, again, it's hard. It's hard. We don't know who could have imagined what happened next. Judy ends up writing later saying that they had the threats in writing. They had the bomb making instructions. They had enough to act and they didn't. And that's what will haunt me forever.
Damn. No, I can imagine.
On the morning of April 20th of 1999, Brooks saw Eric pulling into the school parking lot. So he sees him and they're not really talking. They're former friends. They're not really talking anymore. Brooks was also still friends with Dylan. It was kind of like a trio thing, but him and Eric are just having this fallout.
Yeah.
He's more friends. Brooks is more friends with Dylan. And through
Eric.
Dylan, yeah, it's kind of like they all, yeah.
Like we interact, but you and I are not friends.
Yeah, exactly. They're not friends anymore. Now, when he sees Eric pulling into the school parking lot, Brooks ends up teasing him about skipping a test. But instead of snapping back, Eric looked at him and said, "Brooks, I like you now. Get out of here. Go home."
Yo, what the fuck?
Yes, yes. And Brooks didn't ask any questions. He turned and walked away. Moments later, that's when the attack took place. And he said in interviews before that he's certain that obviously he knows that warning definitely saved his life.
100%.
Which is crazy.
And who knows if he was in a bad mood at that point? Who knows if Brooks had ended up actually being the first target?
Right. And you got to know, too, because I was reading some stuff of people saying, well, like Brooks just left, like he didn't say anything. And it's sometimes they knew him personally, right? Like Brooks obviously knew Eric personally. If they already knew how aggressive he kind of is with certain things, if he says that to me, I'd be like, dude, I really don't want to deal with him today. I'm leaving.
Also, I'm sorry. You're in high school.
Yeah.
No, maybe as an adult, you would think of how can I intervene to correct this? But as a kid, if you are intimidated by somebody that is actually that terrifying to you.
Yeah. Or just kind of like,
you know,
off, like we're just not, you're weird. I'm
not
dealing with you.
You're not
going
to take a risk of I have no idea what he's meaning by this.
Right.
I would immediately just be, all right, I'm going to avoid this confrontation.
I'm going to be like, okay, weirdo, next. Yeah. No, I agree.
But I also wouldn't think that something this drastic was going to happen.
That's my thing. Like, everybody, even after the fact, they say no one would have ever thought this would have happened. And of course, like, who could even, no one can see something like this coming. And that's the thing, too, because I feel we all know somebody who kind of puts you a little on edge and you're just like, oh, my God. Mm-hmm. They say one thing. You're like, never mind. I'm just going to walk away. I just don't even want to deal with it. So I'm sure kind of like that's, or who knows, honestly. That's just me. That's just us assuming. But that's the other thing that I was thinking because of some comments that I've read of people saying like, well, it's kind of crazy how he just like walked away. And I'm like, I hope no one's insinuating the other people are behind this, but you know how the internet kind of takes a shape of its own. Now, Brooks had described Eric as pretty much two-faced, someone who would kind of charm adults and blend in whenever he wanted to, but he had a darker side, a lot of colder side to him, kind of simmering under the surface. And there's this book that he wrote, No Easy Answers, and he says, Eric could make you laugh 1 minute and chill your blood the next. He knew exactly what he was doing. To him, people were chess pieces. So if that's how he kind of knew him,
at a very personal level, because as his parent, as Eric's parents were saying, we didn't know he was like this. And it was his parents. No.
Oh, you're talking about Brooke's parents.
Oh, Brooke's parents. Yes. It's one of those things. Brooke's parents, we didn't even know him like that.
Right.
Even I'm sure his friends that didn't know him on that level, this shows Brooke saw the inside of that. Mm-hmm. He saw the inside of his mind. He saw how he thought.
Well, and he
because
was
this
a
is
part
also
of that.
How Eric was blogging.
Right.
Was in this kind of persona that he didn't allow anyone else to see.
And he only wanted you to see it when he wanted you to see it. Now, Eric and Dylan didn't just want to shoot people. Their plan was actually much bigger and much deadlier. Which I didn't know this. They actually were planning to kill hundreds of students in one massive explosion.
Damn.
The idea was to place two propane tanks in the cafeteria, hidden in duffel bags. They were going to time it to explode during fifth period, which I was seeing that this is the period with the highest number of students, about 450 kids.
Holy shit.
Yes. Would usually be in the cafeteria at this time. And I also watched, I have so many sources and links if you guys are interested in reading, but, or watching. I saw a video on YouTube. It was from one of the staff members, and they said that day they actually had 455 students.
Holy
in the
cow,
cafeteria.
That is insane.
Yes. And so the other more chilling detail is that they actually studied the lunch schedule. They were planning this for a year.
Yeah.
So they were actually studying, like, figuring out which lunch period is going to have the most people.
Wild.
Yes. Now, if the bombs work, the cafeteria was going to collapse, and then that they would just start shooting people as they fled. That was the plan.
Damn.
They also planted diversionary bombs that were either several miles away, hoping to kind of draw first responders away from the school. And they also they called this day Judgment Day.
Holy shit. So literally they're playing God.
Yeah. Yeah. And Eric left behind a manifesto.
Really?
Yes. And he wrote this the night before the shooting. His final message, which I have it here. I'm going to read it to you guys. But again, trigger warning, because this is just a very heavy, very heavy episode. By now, it's over. If you are reading this, my mission is complete. I have finished revolutionizing the neo-euphoric infliction of my internal terror. Your children who have ridiculed me, who have chosen not to accept me, who have treated me like I am not worth their time, are dead. They are effing dead. Surely you will try to blame it on the clothes I wear, the music I listen to, or the way I choose to represent myself. But no, don't hide behind my choices. You need to face the fact that this comes as a result of your choices. Parents and teachers, you effed up. You have taught these kids to be gears and sheep, to think and act like those who came before them, to not accept that what is different. You are in the wrong. I may have taken their lives and my own, but it was your doing. Teachers, parents, let this massacre be on your shoulders until the day you die. Am I insane? Maybe. Is it my fault? No, I did not choose this life, but I have indeed chosen to exit it. You may think the horror ends with the bullet in my head, but you wouldn't be so lucky. All that I can leave you with to decipher what more extensive death is to come is 12 schizo. You have until April 26th. Goodbye. That is the manifesto he left the day before.
Did they ever figure out what that meant?
Yeah, the 12 schizo. So what I was reading is that no one really entirely knows what 12 schizo meant. And it's kind of never really been decoded. And nothing ended up happening on April 26th. But it was kind of clear that Eric wanted this to live on long after.
After him.
After him. And my thing is that I was seeing too, some people speculate that he could just be making you want to look for more, to just kind of keep his memory alive or keep this, inspire energy, other people. Yeah. Yes, inspire other people to do more. Some people speculate it could have just either been a typo, or some people speculate that there were theories that there's also an online following that kind of was idolizing him and wanted to also carry out specific, like they
Damn.
Had. Yeah, I mean, now for Dylan, he didn't really create like one cohesive manifesto or document, no manifesto really, kind of laying out his plan or his ideology. Instead, what he did do is he has scattered entries in like a spiral notebook, personal essays and school assignments. Like he stick papers in certain areas that mm-hmm. read like pieces of a larger, bigger picture.
Okay.
Now his writing swings between kind of romantic longing, kind of very depressed, and flashes of this kind of violent fantasy that he had. And a lot of it is focused on feeling alienated, misunderstood, and desperate for a connection. Now, many pages talk about wanting to die, feeling like his life is unbearable, and imagining an afterlife where he's free from pain. He often used hearts and initials for a girl that he had a crush on, framing her as kind of this, like he can't get that, essentially, mm-hmm. from what it looks like. Now, mixing with those depressive entries are bursts of very dark, violent imagery. He would talk about shooting people, destroying the school, and he actually referenced NBKs, which are natural born killers, which was kind of their code name for the massacre.
Okay.
And some of his English and creative writing projects from senior year contained almost like some type of violent scenarios. Dylan's writings occasionally also mirrored Eric's in terms of planning. There are mentions of guns, explosives, and the attack date, but they're less structured. Eric's journal entries read more like step-by-step blueprints, mm-hmm. and he
was more organized about all of it.
And Dylan was more of like a diary where he was
when he
doing
had
his
a thought,
art
he
burst.
Would kind of write it.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Now, if you can see in there, those are some of the drawings that I could find mm-hmm. that were in their journals or whatnot. So you can see Eric's, and then you can see...
And you can see some of the sketches, too, from the other pages, too.
Right. So it just kind of puts you in perspective of where, how they were feeling at the time, especially Dylan as well. Psychologists now, you know, after the fact, saw Dylan as clinically depressed and suicidal, with the attack of serving partly as a way to end his own life in this kind of blaze of chaos, kind of like a final goodbye. Whereas Eric's writings pretty much indicated psychopath vibe and sadistic motivation.
Mm-hmm.
So very drastically too, you know, Dylan was...
Yeah, but they were also two total different people too they met too. Yes. They were both fighting two total different vibes in
battles
that sense.
And exactly. Yeah. So that's why in moving forward, like you'll see, even up until now, the reason why Dylan, why it went the way it did too, is because he was depressed. He was suicidal. He wanted to end his life. He did not.
Yeah.
He just was not. And Eric also wanted all that because he wanted control. Yeah. He hated everybody. He wanted to take out his rage. So like I said,
it was two different motives.
Yes. But they both were serving each other. Like you said, they were kind of like yin and yang,
feeding off of each other. Yeah.
And Eric is raging outward. Dylan's raging inward. Now, moving forward, I'm going to talk about how the day played out. So, trigger warning. It was Tuesday, April 20th of 1999. The weather was clear and the mood on campus was pretty light. Students were heading to class. Others, like Chris Morris, who I explained earlier, was heading home for lunch just like any other normal day. Eric and Dylan had already been up for hours. They left behind goodbye tapes, they loaded their gear, and by 11:10, they were pulling into the student parking lot at Columbine High School, dressed in long black trench coats, which we know was their getup. underneath those trench coats, they had guns, ammo, knives, and bombs. Their car trunks were filled with gear, and inside, two large duffel bags with propane bombs preset to explode at 11:17 a.m., the start of fifth period lunch, when over 450 students were supposedly going to be in the cafeteria. Now, before Dylan and Eric get there, Craig Scott, a sophomore at Columbine, was in the car with his older sister, Rachel Scott. They were running late as usual. I saw this documentary. He was telling the story that morning. I have to mention, it's very moving, but he had made them late before many times. And he said that morning, Rachel was particularly frustrated with him because he was always making them late.
Bro, you always be late.
You're always late. Now, they argued about the time, and when they pulled up to Columbine, Greg said that he got out the car, slammed the door, and walked off without saying goodbye.
Damn.
Yes. You'll probably see where I'm going with this. 11:10, the bombs are planted. So Eric and Dylan each enter the school carrying the large duffel bag carrying the bombs. The bombs contained 20-pound propane tanks, pipe bombs, and fuel cylinders, and were set to explode at 11:17 a.m. Now, if I'm not wrong, I think that the bombs just had two propane tanks. Whatever. There's the two bags are filled with bombs. Yeah. Okay.
Which, again, wild. That they even, because they're terrorists out there that literally train their whole lives to create timed explosives and aren't successful. And you guys did this over the course of a year, year and a half, whatever, and created this at your age.
At that age. That's crazy
wild
part. Yep. So they were set to explode at 11:17, right? At this point, their goal was simple, like I said. They wanted to collapse the floor above them, right? Because the bombs are going to collapse it and kill as many people as possible in one explosion. Because people are going to run out because there's an explosion. Yeah. They left the bomb, they exited the school calmly, and they returned to their cars and waited. But when 11:17 came and went, nothing exploded. So thankfully the bombs didn't go off. Because if they did, and there would have been a lot more casualties, and it could have definitely killed 500 people.
I can imagine.
So they end up pivoting. They have a plan B. They are going to get out of the car and just start opening fire. That was their plan B. So it was 11:17. It didn't go off. It's 11:19. That's when the shooting begins. At the west entrance of Columbine High School, Eric and Dylan approach with shotguns and rifles hidden underneath their trench coats. Now, this is near the outdoor commons area where many students go to eat and hang out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's closest to the cafeteria.
Okay.
Sitting outside eating lunch is Rachel Scott and her friend Richard Castaldo. Without hesitation or warning, Eric fires. Rachel is hit multiple times. She dies instantly. Richard is shot in the chest, arm and back, paralyzed from the chest down. And then Eric and Dylan fire on students sitting at nearby picnic tables, tossing pipe bombs and shooting randomly. They're just shooting. Some students run. Others drop to the ground. Some bombs detonate. Some others fail.
Mm-hmm.
Now, during the attack, from what I was seeing, Eric and Dylan used roughly around 90 total explosive devices.
Jesus Christ.
That were recovered. That's like pipe bombs, propane bombs, and car bombs.
That is wild.
I think it was over 30 pipe bombs. Now, again, if I'm not 100% right about these numbers, just know it was just a lot of bombs that they did. Now, around over 30 of them were pipe bombs, and they, throughout the whole shooting, the whole massacre, they were just kind of tossing them in the air, they just wanted to cause chaos. That's what they wanted. And about only 10 of them detonated successfully, causing injuries and panic still, but 10.
Yeah.
Now, imagine being the police squad having to, that's just insane.
Well, one, you're showing up to a school shooting, but then two, you find out that the school shooters are also throwing bombs and you don't know how many.
Right. Now, there's a lot of other bombs as well that they planted that were later recovered by bomb squads that did not explode, thankfully. Mm-hmm. So those did not detonate. But they were throwing them into hallways, onto rooftops, toward fleeing students inside the library and the cafeteria. Like, they didn't care. They were just throwing it everywhere. Now, these homemade devices were filled with nails, BBs, and powder meant to hurt and injure.
Yeah.
And they threw pipe bombs at the parking lot and roof and exchanged gunfire at one point with the deputy on, not, I don't want to say on staff, but the one that's nearby.
Oh, they had somebody.
Yeah, the deputy Gardner. He was trying to prevent them from entering the cafeteria, but unfortunately that did not work. Now, inside the school, the fire alarm is triggered, not because of the gunfire, but because of the small explosives that they had planted. It caused a lot of confusion because many teachers are now thinking, oh, it's a fire drill. You know, let's start locking down the classroom. Let's start getting everybody out. So, I mean, you can only imagine the chaos. Now, meanwhile, in the library, which is, I will give you a heads up now, this is a big trigger. That is probably the most tragic. All of it is tragic. Okay, the whole thing is tragic. The library has to be one of the most tragic parts of this whole timeline. Students hear gunfire, but at first they think it's fireworks. People are thinking it might be a senior prank because this is around senior prank time. Yes. And just, and another thing that I saw is that only 3 days earlier, they were at prom and they went to prom.
Damn.
Yeah, Dylan went to, like, his mom, there's a photo of Dylan.
Holy shit.
With his date, like, going to prom. Yes. So, like I said, no one could have ever even imagined that this is what's going to happen. So people are thinking it's a senior prank. They start hiding under tables, behind bookshelves, or in adjacent rooms, anywhere they can. Obviously, what can you do? Now, one of the first students injured inside the school was Sean Graves. He was age 15. He was near the cafeteria when he saw the two boys in trench coats and duffel bags loading what looked like weapons. But Sean and his friends, again, they all assumed it was a part of a senior prank, maybe toy guns, right?
Mm-hmm.
That illusion of what he thought he saw kind of shattered seconds later when they actually started opening fire. And Sean was shot multiple times in the abdomen, the legs, and the back, and he collapsed. During that time, he was paralyzed and he was trying to drag himself towards the hallway door calling for help. He would later say that months earlier, he actually had a nightmare that either him or a family member would become paralyzed, but he had no idea that it would be him.
Damn, that's wild.
And thankfully, he survived. He is now able to walk and he beat all odds. But as you can imagine, it changed everything because you can't come back from that.
No.
He did say that it took him a very long time to... The doctors were telling him that his odds were really low, and he's like, I don't give a fuck. Like, I'm going to walk again. Yeah. He had to pretty much learn everything all over again. Yeah. And thankfully, he is alive today. But I also want to take out, which you're going to see as we keep going forward, is that I want to talk about each of the victims, those that were affected, those that survived, those that didn't, because they also they deserve to be spoken about and for their memory to live on. Okay. It's 11:22 now. The first deputy on duty is Neil Gardner, right? Like I said, he's the school's assigned sheriff.
Okay.
Yes, that's what I was trying to say.
Yeah. So he's the one that's on staff on the school.
Yeah, that's why I was like, I don't want to say he's on staff, but like
he's more or less on staff.
Technically, okay, yes, exactly. Now he's stationed outside and he hears the gunfires. He's calling for backup and he races to the west side. There, that's when he exchanges shots with Eric near the west entrance, but obviously is outgunned. So Eric.
Well, yeah, because I'm sorry, you're doing school protection. You're probably carrying a 9mm or 45. Either way, it's a pistol of some type. And these guys are loaded up with assault rifles.
Right. Bombs, knives.
Yeah.
Everything. There's also a sawed-off shotgun.
Holy sh... Okay, well...
Yeah, but that's insane.
Yes. Oh, from that far, depending on how the distance, the sawed-off shotgun is less of a threat to the cop at that distance.
Damn. Yeah. But even if you were to... I mean, you can...
Sorry for clearing my throat.
No, you're good. But you can... it causes damage, though.
Yeah, sawed-off...
I know it wouldn't probably cause him because of how far he was, but still, yeah.
So the point of a sawed-off shotgun is... So a shotgun shell is pellets.
Mm-hmm.
So think of like a pellet rifle. Think of a bunch of mini pellet rifle bullets all shoved into that tiny shell.
You showed me a video, yes.
What that actually allows to happen is those... pellets are able to spread a little bit faster.
Wow.
So from up close, it can cause a lot more damage because now if you're shooting at somebody, and this is going to be kind of gruesome, if you shoot at somebody or something, instead of you hitting it and it leaving a reasonable amount of, like a reasonable hole, you can potentially have a wider spread to where now you're causing even more damage.
Wow. Okay. That's what I figured, because I remember you had told me once, I forgot what we were talking about, guns or something.
Yeah.
Because I really have no type of knowledge in guns whatsoever.
And if I recall, I want to say that in the whole entire U.S., and this, somebody can fact check me, this might be wrong, I believe sawed-off shotguns are actually completely illegal because of this.
I was going to say, yes, because, what is it? He ended up acquiring, I'm going to get more into it, but pretty much Dylan and Eric, like, they got these guns illegally. Mm-hmm. Like somebody, a friend gave it to them, sold it to them.
Who the fuck do you know at that age?
That even needs that. I don't really know about guns like that, but yes, I agree. Because I remember I saw that and it wasn't like, I don't think it's something that you can, and again, don't quote me, but I don't think it's something that you can just easily do. Just saw it off or something, right?
Yeah, you could.
Oh, you can? Okay, never mind.
It's just metal.
I'm learning. Okay. Okay, well, that's good to know. That's good to know. But that's how they acquired it. Now, Eric retreats inside once, you know, they kind of have this shootout. He calls
back. Well, yeah, the minute Eric pushed him off, then all of a sudden now he's, okay, cool. I got time because nobody's here. I got to go on and carry my plan out, not just focus on this one person.
Right. Now, here is, I mean, not even here, this whole story is just a sucky part. But one of the sucky parts is that when officers began arriving, instead of entering, they have to follow protocol at the time. The protocol is to just contain the perimeter and wait for SWAT. No rescue team goes inside. So instead of entering immediately, law enforcement just does the protocol, sets up the perimeter. Meanwhile, teachers are calling 911, students are hiding in the closets, people are getting shot, others are bleeding out in classrooms, and inside the library is where this horror is going to peak.
Which again, I just want to reiterate, because I think students now, or even anyone that's in their younger 20s,
mm-hmm.
is going to think of when you do... I don't know if all schools do this. We used to practice lockdowns.
We did, yes.
And I remember one of the things that this prompted was actually instead of practicing a lockdown and then saying, oh, if you hear a fire alarm, then exit. That was the theory back then was,
you just lock yourself up in the room. Yeah.
Yeah. But now, because of Columbine,
they used to talk about it
and they would practice. And I remember one of our drills, we were in one of the highest level lockdowns you can be, where you had to hide in everything, and we had a taped line in every single classroom where we knew exactly where a shooter couldn't see, and the principal set off the fire alarms to try to deter, because even teachers at that time only knew that it was a lockdown drill,
right?
So it was kind really of a prompt to try to see, and nobody failed, because even teachers said, do not get up. This is, stay where you are. It's part of the drill.
Right.
Which part of us, I think I remember after, a few of us were kind of like, again, we're high schoolers. We didn't know much. But we were kind of like, yo, what the hell? What if there was an actual fire and you have us in like a lockdown drill?
Oh, it's true.
But then even one of our teachers kind of came over and said, yeah, if that was true, then... they probably would have gotten on the PA and said, look, students, like the drill's over. There's an actual fire. Get the fuck out.
Yeah. Why didn't I even think of that? Because in my head, I'm like, yeah, that's so true. But it's like, it's not like
it's a drill. So it's
not real. The principal's going to be like, oh my God, it's a real fire. I'm not going to let anybody know. I'm just run. Yeah. No, that's so true. No, that is so true.
Yeah.
But
this whole thing changed a lot of processes.
Yeah. And I love that you brought that up, because that is something that some of the deputies speak about now, that they said that day was a failure. A lot of people will be like, well, no, we did exactly what we were supposed to. And it's like, yes and no. It just sucked how the outcome went.
They did everything they knew.
They knew
at that time.
At the time what to do, until afterwards, when Columbine did happen, they were like, this is not at all how we should have handled this. Like, we should probably do this. So there are a lot of new protocols in place because of what that happened. And they have been trying to train more police moving forward to know, like, hey, listen, you know, you signed up to be in the line of fire.
Yeah.
You will have to, because at the time, one of the deputies, and I'll link the video of the interview. He was one of the SWATs on that day, and he had said how some people thought, oh no, well, that's not our job, that's SWAT's job. And it's every, like, we're here to protect, well, yeah. You know,
because again, back in
It's hard. That's what I mean. That was a thought process.
I was going to say, if you look at even the movies around police films, and back then there was a TV show literally called SWAT. It since has been remade.
Yeah.
And it was phenomenal. But back in the day, if it was something crazy like this, as a cop, you weren't intervening.
Right.
You were just exactly what you they're talking. You secured the perimeter. You waited for SWAT to get on scene because
that was
SWAT
protocol.
Was your cops that were the most highly trained, tactical guys. A lot of them former military. They knew how they've been trained on how to clear buildings, how to work with negotiations, all this different stuff. And that's why you used to wait on SWAT.
Right.
But now we've even seen police training change to where not everyone's SWAT, obviously, but you have a lot more officers that are trained to understand how to handle situations like this, even while they're waiting on SWAT or a higher team to be able to show up.
Correct. And right. And that's a thing, too, that, I mean, it just sucks. There's going to be other, there's a lot of other shootings like the Uvalde shooting, the school shooting. You've never heard of that one?
I don't think so.
That was another mass shooting, that school shooting that took place in 2022 at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas.
Oh, yes, Texas.
I know you know exactly. Yeah, you know what it is. It's just that's the name of the school.
Name.
Yeah, and the thing that happened was that the shooter was inside one of the classrooms. Cops were literally down the hall, but they didn't.
Yes,
because they were following. I don't really know exactly. Yeah. Crazy amount of details on that, but I remember it was very heartbreaking for so many because nobody
there was a
did
lot
anything.
Of outrage on it on both sides, and it was a lot of the cops trying to let everyone else understand why they didn't do it, and then there was also
I remember people saying like no, they do things wrong. Whatever, that's for something else. But at this point, Eric and Dylan are continuing to move through the halls. They're tossing pipe bombs, they're shooting at random people that come across them. Several of the bombs that they threw failed to detonate, and some later had to be defused by the bomb squads, like I said earlier. Now, they are shooting at windows, they're shooting at classrooms, they are firing into the cafeteria from above. Luckily, most of the students had actually evacuated that area, but there were still some that remained hidden. By 11:29, I was seeing the library was pretty much packed. Students had rushed in for cover kind of after they were hearing the gunfire, and inside they were hiding under tables, behind bookshelves, inside rooms. Craig Scott was one of those in the library. He crawled under a table with his friends Matt Ketcher and Isaiah Scholes. They were holding still, and that's when Eric and Dylan stormed in. Now, at the time, the librarian that was there that day, Patty Nielsen, she had called 911 at around 11:25, and her last call lasted over 27 minutes. On the other end, the dispatcher was Renee Napoli. Renee later said that the things that she heard, she'll never, ever forget. Because she, in her interview, she said, all I could do was listen to people getting murdered because there was nothing else that she could do. Now, she was hearing the screams, she was hearing gunshots, and she was even hearing laughter in the exact moments that students were killed. Yes. She recalls feeling completely helpless, just...
because what the fuck do? You
can't do anything, yes. There were 4 staff members and 52 students, from what I was reading, hiding in the library at this time. So that's a lot.
Yeah.
Now, at first, when the shootings were going off, some of the students that were in there said that they thought it was fireworks or it was a student prank.
They thought
prank.
That it was the prank, yeah.
Right, which is crazy hearing the perspective of everybody from different parts of the school that day, because a lot of people thought the same thing. Oh, it's just a school prank or something's going off.
I mean,
whatever.
Again, most schools are also made out of cinder block, and a gunshot from that far is probably going to sound like just a pop.
Yes.
It's not going to sound like... Yeah.
That's a good point.
It's a gunshot.
That's a good point. And when Patty, what they said happened was Patty came in, like closed the door, and she was telling everybody, like, get under the tables right now, like there's somebody with a gun or something, right? Now, at one point, Patty whispers that they're in the library because they enter and they start shooting off their guns. Then you would hear silence, then, you know, more shots and breathing. There would be a voice that yells, get up, then more gunfire. Now, over a dozen of 911 calls came in during the attack from classrooms, from closets, from bathrooms, the library itself.
Yeah. And again, not just for people of our generation, but anyone that's a little younger at this time, you also got to remember what year this is.
Yeah.
Cell phones were not a thing for students.
Nothing crazy.
You didn't.
Yeah.
If you had one,
I think it's a luxury.
Well, yeah. And I remember my dad's cell phone at this time was a freaking brick. All it did was call. And it had an antenna and a big ass battery.
I'm like, when was the first flip phone? The first flip phone was actually made in 1996.
Damn.
So again, if you did have a flip phone, I mean, it says that they became luxury. Yeah, it says flip phones became even more popular in 2000. So yeah, I mean, if you think about it, that was probably progressing as the day went on. Yeah. So if you did have, and not like everybody had a flip phone at the time. Yeah. So yeah, you're right about that. True. Now, when Eric and Dylan, when they came into the library, their demeanor was, I mean, chilling. They were laughing. They were hooting. They were hollering. They were taunting the students. They were firing blindly. They were also, from what I was reading, and it broke my heart, they were like, peekaboo. And like,
damn. Oh,
I know. I literally...
Which again, this is the sad thing is that this is exactly what they were wanting.
That's what they wanted.
So for them, this was probably like, entertainment. This was enjoyment for them.
It was a game.
And that sucks.
Yeah. And it's like a terrible thing.
What the fuck? There's a movie. No, not a movie. I think it is a book or a movie too. But then I want to say there was a serial killer that talked about this, and it was called The Deadliest Game.
Oh, where he would shoot down. He would hunt his
victims.
Like he would, yes, he would get his victims and then he'd leave them in and have them running in the woods and he would hunt them down. No, it wasn't the Zodiac. No, it was another one. But yes. Now, the first victim that was shot when they came in was 16-year-old Kyle Velasquez. He was sitting alone at the computer when Eric and Dylan stormed in. Kyle had special needs and he was known for his very gentle and kind spirit. He had recently started attending Columbine and felt pretty safe in the library. He didn't really have too much time to react and it seemed like he didn't. Craig Scott has said that he didn't really know that he needed to hide. So he was shot and killed almost immediately, the very first victim in the library. Kyle's death was instant and his story it's heartbreaking. Everyone's story is heartbreaking. So if you guys hear me saying that, it's just, I don't know how else to, like, every story is freaking heartbreaking. He had kind of found his place at Columbine. He loved the library. It was supposed to be kind of a safe space for him. His family said that he liked simple things like panda bears and coloring. Craig Scott said that in the library, when they were there was a documentary that he speaks on, that a lot of the people in the library were staying quiet and a lot of the girls were crying. And they were kind of treating it like it was a game. Exactly what you were saying. Mm-hmm. And they were having a lot of fun doing it because they would kind of taunt all the students. They would do the peekaboo. They would say certain things like that. So imagine how chilling that is. Now, after they're going on their rampage, they came over to where Craig Scott was and saw Isaiah Scholes, who was 18. Now, he was one of the very few African-American students at Columbine, or honestly, in Littleton in general. The population was very, very small, if any, very non-existent. Now, he was an athlete. He was beloved by friends. And as he hid under the table, Dylan actually pointed him out, called Eric over using racial slurs. I'm not going to say it, but look at this word.
Mm-hmm.
And pulled him out from under the table. And right before they killed him, Greg said that Isaiah's last words were, "I want to see my mom."
Damn.
They turned their guns towards Matt and shot him. And Craig played dead. He didn't want to draw any attention to himself. He just lied still in a pool of his friend's blood.
That fucking sucks.
He laid there and he could hear pretty much his friend's like last breaths being taken. Eric and Dylan at this point end up exiting the library around 11:36 and continue shooting through the school. Now, there's some eyewitness accounts from inside. Lisa Kruitz, who was shot but survived, said that the boys walked very slowly between the tables, laughing and calling students out. Val Schnurr, after being shot, she cried out, "Oh my God, oh my God." And Dylan asked her if she believed in God. And when she said yes, he for some reason walked away. He spared her life.
What the fuck?
Yeah, it's very confusing.
Which is wild because it... What the fuck?
That's very confusing. Yes.
It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. Many of them heard Eric and Dylan yelling peekaboo before firing at students. at students. The shooters also shouted, "Everyone with a white hat, stand up," which is kind of like they were targeting jocks who wore them, but nobody moved, obviously, yeah. Which again comes hand in hand with they had friends. It's not like they were outcasts. Yeah. It's just really weird. Like, I mean, again, there was no rhyme or reason for who they were targeting. Yeah. It was just whoever and anyone that was in their way they were
going to take out.
If they felt like it, they would. If they didn't, they didn't.
Yeah, because it doesn't give Eric's blog entries give I'm bullied. I want to take this out on all the people that have bullied me. The way that they carried out the shooting and the school shooting, that doesn't give I was bullied and I just want to take out the people that bullied me. That gives I just want to cause chaos and mass casualties.
Like
I don't care who gets killed. I want to kill you.
Like what psychologists are saying, like he's giving psychopath behavior. Like he has no empathy, no apathy, nothing. Now, when they were in the library in just 7 minutes, Eric and Dylan killed 10 students and injured 12 more in the library. Many students did survive by playing dead. Craig Scott was one of them. One student, Patrick Ireland, is shot in the head twice and shot once in the foot, but he survives. He ends up losing consciousness briefly, then somehow wakes up. He's very disoriented, bleeding. He spends 3 hours dragging himself 50 feet across the library and past dead students to the window ledge. And he pulled himself out of the shattered window and was rescued by SWAT officers.
Holy fuck.
He's caught on news video.
Holy shit.
Yes, he's caught on news video. He's the famous boy in the window. If anybody has ever seen news coverage or any photos of it, there is a boy that the SWAT team is helping come out of the window. And that is Patrick Ireland. So he survived that. Now today, Patrick is a motivational speaker and a financial advisor. He has overcame brain damage. He relearned how to speak and walk, and he continues to share his story publicly till this day. When Craig was able to finally run out to safety, right when they felt like it was safe enough, he actually didn't even realize that he also passed right by his sister's body.
Fuck.
Because Rachel was one of the first ones that was shot. Yes. And I mean, if you think about it now, everybody talks about it. Like a lot of people don't remember that day.
Yeah, you're also trauma. Well, I was going to say, one, you're blacked out.
Yeah, the adrenaline.
From everything going on.
Yes.
But two, in a moment like that, your own only concern isn't looking around at who is around you. It's, I just want to get the fuck out of here.
Right, right. That's all you can think about. After exiting the library briefly, Eric and Dylan returned nearly 40 minutes later. They had wandered the school. They tried to detonate more bombs, but they failed. There is footage of them going back to the cafeteria and shooting at one of the bombs that was there because it didn't go off. And I think it just caused, it didn't cause an explosion. It caused, it got into fire. And why can't I say what it is? But you know exactly what I mean. It caught fire and everything. So when they returned to the library again and approached the windows, they started having kind of a shootout with the police by the broken windows. And then without warning and without any witnesses, they turned the guns on themselves. Eric died from a self-inflicted shotgun wound to the roof of his mouth, and Dylan died from a shot to the left temple with a TEC-9 handgun.
Which, again, I'm sorry, but such a fucking pansy way out.
I know.
You're such a man to, like, take on something like this.
Right.
And then you can't even...
Like, to feel that you're so misunderstood that you're saying that, especially Eric saying, oh, this isn't on my shoulders, it's on yours. Like, this is it's like he wanted the control.
Yes.
Yes.
And again, it would make, not that it would make sense.
It would kind of be more under, yes, I know
you
what
know
you're
what
saying.
I'm trying to explain.
Yes.
It would at least make more sense, I guess, is the best way to fucking put it. If he truly targeted people that bullied him.
Right.
But you didn't target
anyone. That would be
anyone.
A motive, right?
Yes.
That would be a motive of
100%.
Why this happened, because it was a bully yes. related. But no, this is just
and it
strictly.
Would be, and then you taking yourself out at the end would literally be a, I'm alone. I took out the people that fucked me up and have bullied the hell out of me.
Right.
And this is all that I cared about.
And right.
But you guys took out as many people as you could. Innocent people. People that had nothing to do with anything in you, and you had friends.
Yes.
You had people that tried to be your friend.
Yes, exactly. Now, there are no witnesses to this moment, only the sound of the gunfire that were picked up. So no one really saw them commit suicide. Yes. But the crazy part is that from the first shots to the shooter's suicide, the entire attack lasted 49 minutes from 11:19 to 12:08.
Jesus.
Law enforcement doesn't end up entering the school until hours. SWAT entered at around like 1:09. I was reading over an hour after the shooters were already dead. There were a lot of injured students laying there waiting to receive help that never came. So now one of the victims that they all suffered from this, but teacher Dave Sanders, William Dave Sanders, who had been shot earlier, he was guiding students to safety. He actually bled out and died nearly 3 hours after he was shot because they didn't come in they came in too late.
So if they had gotten in earlier...
Yes, yes. And the thing that is crazy about him is that one of the students were helping him into a room to kind of help, like, wait, because he was bleeding out, was trying to help him and get him out of the gunfire. They wrote on a clipboard that said, one, bleeding to death, pretty much trying to notify, and they hung it on the window so to notify those that, hey, there's somebody bleeding to death in here. And the sad part is that his daughter and his wife had said that they were looking at the news and they actually saw that in the news from outside.
Damn.
And little did they know that that was
for their,
and the window that it was, that he was in, like the room he was in, was the one under, it was on top. The exit door was under him. So it's like, he was so close.
There.
Yes. It's just a pivotal moment. It just kind of shows you a lot. So investigators actually recovered more than the 90 improvised explosive devices, like I said. They even had Molotov cocktails.
Holy fuck.
Yes, yes. And the two propane tanks that were weighing like 20 pounds each, but those were the ones that failed to explode in the cafeteria. They also placed like car bombs I was seeing in the parking lot. So
I'm assuming they probably thought that students maybe were going to try to escape to their cars.
Maybe, yeah. It seemed like they just wanted to cause chaos. Massive casualty, exactly. Now, damn, dude, you know, it's heavy because of this, like we've been talking, it has forever changed everything moving forward. I mentioned the basement tapes earlier. What we know about those, because I know you said you don't know about them now. Mm-hmm. Before the massacre ever happened, they spent hours in Eric's family basement making what they say was their legacy. In these tapes, they're not hiding anything. They show off their shotguns, their pistols, their homemade bombs. They're showing them like trophies. Dylan even cradles his weapon, and Eric's got one of his, Arlene, I think it's one of his guns, mm-hmm. or maybe his bombs, I'm not sure. And they're drinking like whiskey while they're talking through their plans. It's very chilling. Now, according to the journalists who were later allowed to see them, some of the basement tapes are available that you can see them. It kind of looks like these skits that they've done. I'll talk more about it. But this one that I'm talking about, them in the basement, and this was shot like the day before the massacre. It's one of their darkest ones that's been destroyed since 2011. They destroyed that. They don't want mm-hmm. anybody to. They're afraid that it'll copycats or inspire, or they just, it's so dark that they're like, it's unnecessary to see them in that light. Eric was pretty much the ringleader here. He really leans into the camera. He's very animated. He's sneering, almost performing. And Dylan is much quieter of the two. He's kind of more slouched, but when he talks, there's a lot of bitterness to him, this kind of hopelessness to him. Now, one of the reporters described him as kind of like a lost soul along for the ride, but still very dangerous. The mood kind of jumps all over the place. One minute they're laughing about weird little skits. One of the skits that they created was called Hitman for Hire, or another one that it's labeled Radioactive Clothes, which I guess is a joke. But the next, they're listing like classmates that they want dead. They talk numbers. They talk pretty much the propane bombs, like how they're going to set off to go. They're pretty much talking their whole plan. The whole plan, they are mm-hmm. just fucking talking about it all. They actually were apparently referencing Nazi references sprinkled
Damn.
In. Yeah, apparently Hitler comes up, but it's more about like Eric's warped survival of the fittest mindset and his kind of anti-Semitic remarks that played into that ideology.
That's weird.
Yes. One of the journalists said that watching it felt like seeing two young men unravel in real time. And the cruelty is casual because Dylan jokes about haunting survivors, making noises that would trigger kind of flashbacks. Eric talks about how people will write books about them, that they wanted to be remembered, and not for who they were, but for what they did. So, I mean, thinking about seeing how apparently Hitler was mentioned, that's kind of interesting. But the tapes were, like I said, never meant for the public. Only a very small group of people were able to see them before law enforcement kind of locked them away. And then they ended up just destroying them, most of them actually in 2011 because of the copycats, and they were just kind of worried about them. But some people thought like, oh, some people feel like they should have been maybe accessible to professionals to help decide, like psychologists really kind of understand the mind of psychopaths or the type of mentality that they were thinking of. But other people say that it just shouldn't live. So ultimately they ended up destroying it.
Yeah.
Yes. Now the only thing that has survived are just fragments. Maybe there's like some partial transcripts, even though some people say there are transcripts. I don't think there are from what I was reading. There are still kind of quotes. There's still frames, but from certain basement videos. Again, you can see there are some videos that they still have available online, and it's their skits. It's literally them pretending to like shoot other people. It kind of reminded me of a very macabre, chilling, dark Michael Scott. You know how he does his own skits of his own, but it's pretty much them either shooting people out. It's very eerie, disturbing. Yeah, very disturbing. It's like they're doing a skit of them. They're in their own movie, pretty much.
Which is, again, back to everything. That's kind of how it seems like they wanted this to be.
Right. Exactly. And it's like they were living their own movie. Now, as for the date that they chose, from what I was reading, right, so they ended up acting out on this on April 20th of 1999. That wasn't the original plan, apparently. They initially intended to carry out the attack on April 19th, my sister's birthday.
You mean the short one?
The one my short sister than? Yes, I'm taller than her, which was the anniversary of both the Waco siege and the Oklahoma City bombing, which were two major anti-government events. But apparently the delays in building the bombs kind of pushed them to the next morning, and I mean they ended up making 90, so that's insane.
Which again is so fucking wild.
And I remember seeing some people like theorizing that April 20th was also Hitler's birthday, I think, or something, but there's no concrete evidence, so anything that points that way. Some stuff that people have kind of mentioned that they thought it was interesting, like, oh, the 20th, does that have a correlation there? They were just trying to make sure that they were remembered. That's really what they wanted. Now, it's one thing to read in the news articles about what they planned, but it's also another to hear them like laughing about it and holding their weapons like they're just like old friends. These tapes were pretty much just a window into the last months before April 20th took place. That is the rampage video. So the rampage video, or am I saying it wrong? Is it rampart? Yes, I always say it wrong. So the rampart video that some people mention is pretty much them. I think it was like days before. It was pretty recent where they have the guns and stuff and they are in the woods with some friends and they're just shooting things off. They're also referencing like, oh, shoot it at the tree. I want to see how much damage it does. They shoot the sawed-off shotgun. Jesus. Yes. And when they get close, it's kind of eerie because it's eerie because we know what we know of now.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for that, seeing that video, I was seeing it as like, oh, you know, he was like, shoot the tree. I want to see how much damage it causes. When they get close and do a close up, they're like, look at that. Imagine that in somebody's head. Like,
holy fuck.
And they're with some friends at the time. But again, no one would know what this would come of. After this happened, which remember how I said some friends, right? Mm-hmm. After this happened, there were some arrests and some charges. Mark Maines, in August of 1999, Mark Maines pleads guilty to supplying the TCDC-9 pistol. That's a mouthful. But, and 100 rounds of ammunition to the killers. He admitted that he did sell the gun to the miners and delivered the ammunition the night before the massacre.
Holy shit.
He didn't know, but he still pled because he did, he did sell it illegally. Now, in November of 1999, he was sentenced to 6 years in prison for selling the weapon and 3 years to be served concurrently for possessing a sawed-off shotgun. So like you said, was it legal?
Yeah.
No, it were not. At sentencing, prosecutors were reading excerpts from the killer's tapes, including Dylan's thanking Mark and Phil for helping them get a gun. Mark, he expresses a lot of remorse for that, and he even says that he never wants to see a gun again. He ends up serving his time in prison, and he was released, but he reportedly ended up rebuilding his life and just avoids the public overall.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't even imagine. No one's ever the same after that.
No. Again, it obviously, even if you're a criminal, to me, this is just my view, if you're a criminal and you're a small-time criminal that supplies guns and stuff,
right.
And I'm sorry, who the fuck's going to think two 18-year-olds, even if they are a little weird,
yeah,
you're not going to think that they're actually going to go at that time.
At that time, yeah.
Now, you probably would think different.
Yeah.
But at that time, you're not going to think these two 18-year-olds. You're probably just going to think, oh, they're probably just stupid. I mean, I'm going to make easy money.
Yeah.
They're probably going to go show these off to their friends and be like, look, I have a sawed-off shotgun.
I also wonder, too, because some people are like, oh, yeah, I want my kids to, if they're interested in guns, cool, not a big deal. So
mm-hmm.
I could see that as well, being a part in it. So I totally 100% agree with what you're saying. Now, Philip Duran, he was the friend that introduced the killers to Mark. He did plead guilty to supplying a weapon to minors and was sentenced to 4.5 years. That's all I really kind of saw of him.
Yeah.
Robin Anderson. Now, she ends up testifying before the Colorado legislature that she bought two shotguns and a rifle for Eric and Dylan at a gun show without a background check and said that she would not have done so if it were illegal. Now, authorities did not charge her because the purchase was legal at the time.
I was going to say, even to this day, that in, I think all states are different, but to this day, that is still a massive thing
problem.
In law.
Yes.
Is that certain gun shows in certain states, you don't have to run a background check. You don't even have to put who the hell bought it.
Right.
You can literally just put, you sold the gun.
Right. Hence the gun control policies that people are trying to pass. Correct. Yeah. No, right. Now, her testimony did help inspire the Robin Anderson bill, which criminalized giving firearms to minors without parental consent. She really tried to make a movement after that. She now lives a very private life. You know, she also testified in favor of gun control laws and has expressed a lot of sincere regret because, again, nobody knew that this was going to happen. Now, there were some civil suits and other kind of legal actions. Families of several victims filed lawsuits against the gun suppliers and Jefferson County. Most of the cases were dismissed or settled. And according to this article I read on history.com, Mark and Philip were pretty much the only ones that were sentenced to prison. Some of the victims' families sued the sheriff's office, saying that they were negligent, but courts generally ruled that the decisions that law enforcement made were discretionary and protected by immunity because they followed protocol. Early on in the media, it was suggested that the killers were victims of bullies, but that
isn't actually the truth.
Yes. That, I mean, not that from what I was seeing and a lot of the article I was reading, like maybe they were kind of like picked on sometimes, but it didn't at all seem like that would have even been an actual motivator for these things. Now, while both of them were experiencing that social frustration and were expressing admiration for the violence of it all, psychologists argue that their motives just kind of stemmed from complex psychopathology. Mm-hmm. My goodness. Psychologist Peter Langman and journalist Dave Cullen, they emphasized that Eric was a narcissistic psychopath who sought to dominate and destroy, while Dylan was a suicidal depressive who just pretty much was following Eric's lead.
Yeah, because he felt like he belonged.
And they understood each other better than anybody else. So two peas in a pod, in a terrible, horrific pod.
But again, if somebody's marked also to me, if you're also marked as a narcissist, that means that you also know exactly how to...
Right.
I don't want to say...
manipulate people?
Manipulate, but groom.
Groom.
You know exactly how to groom
That's
somebody.
True.
And to me, someone like Dylan, depressed, you can clearly tell he needs something. Boom. Perfect somebody, especially if you're wanting to cause mass casualty. It's easy if you're a narcissist, to right. kind of, you know, get in that mind space of how can I groom this person to almost
have
be
the
a
outcome
follower.
That I want. Yes. Yeah. And it's crazy because Sue Klebold, which is Dylan's mom, she's an advocate. She talks now. She does a lot of public speaking. One of the questions that I kept seeing when she was in interviews that they asked was if she had asked Dylan more about his mental health, would this have happened? Mm-hmm. And she said that she believes that he would have not been a part of it. She doesn't know if it would have happened with Dylan or without Dylan. It would have happened regardless with how Eric was thinking. But she did think that it would have saved a lot, or at least saved her son from doing that, which is, again, it really sucks, because what I was noticing from all the research was that at the time, so many people also blamed her. Because they thought it was like a, you know, it was how she parents her child. Was she even there? How does she let all this pass? It's a lot of blaming. I feel that everyone's a victim here. Okay. And it comes back to that question that people have: are killers born or are they raised?
Yeah.
So, but again, like, he lived in a loving home. Like, she speaks about it. She's like, they tried getting him help, because remember a year and a half prior, they got caught stealing. Trouble, yeah. They were trying to, you know, he had to go to diversion.
I feel like you can't put that on someone like that. There's times I think there's plenty of evidence that points directly to it was how they were raised. But prime example, how many times have you heard today with shootings, you hear the story of, oh, well, they play a lot of Call of Duty. They play a lot of GTA. The games that the kids are playing today are all violent. One, those games are almost all rated M, should be 17 and older. Parents are buying those games, whatever. But at the same time, to me, I also know plenty of kids I grew up with that we were all playing rated M games in middle school, elementary school. But it was never something that you took and developed into, you know what would be a cool idea? Like, I should go shoot people in real life.
Right.
And again, obviously, mental health has changed a lot of this, but I think that part of that has also been kind of that argument, too, of
it's complex.
What caused it.
Yeah, it's very complex.
And same thing with that. I don't think you can always take a school shooting or whatever and say, oh, it's the parent, or, oh, it was the video games that they're playing.
Yeah.
There's also a lot of internal stuff within that person themselves that you also have to understand.
Yeah, we'll never, it's hard. Like, sometimes we'll never really know. That's why a lot of the scientists, they want to study their brains. They want to study their behavioral patterns, how they want to study them in themselves, their environment, how they grew up and all that, because that will lead to more information. And understanding of is there a way we could prevent this? Is there a way that we can see that? But again, it's so complex. It is so complex. Like, I can't even wrap my head around it. I'm sure there's probably even more than what we're even saying, because we're not experts on it. But yes, I 100% agree, because that's the thing. Like, in the weeks after the tragedy, the community, they were making memorials. They were doing they were hand making crosses, they were doing handwritten notes, and that later gave way to the permanent Columbine Memorial in Clement Park. It opened in 2007. It holds a ring of remembrance engraved with each victim's names and stories, and a wall of healing, it's called, where it's covered in messages from around the world. Columbine also left its mark on a lot of media and culture. I mean, books like Dave Cullen's Columbine and Sue Klebold's, which was Dylan's mother, A Mother's Reckoning. There's a lot of documentaries like Michael Moore's Bowling for Columbine, and even the dark phrase Going Columbine that also entered the lexicon, which is just crazy. And the reason why I want to just mention all these sources as well is because there's so much information out there about Columbine. It's been 25 years now, I think. Yes, it's been 26.
Holy shit,
would be this year.
26.
26 years now. So a lot of the survivors, a lot of the victims' families, a lot of those who just lived around there have came up and spoken about it. There's plenty of interviews. There's a lot of motivational speakers. It's just insane. Now, because of this, a lot of the policy shifted too. Remember how we were talking about that as well?
Yeah.
There's zero tolerant policies in schools. There's a lot of tighter security. And the closure of the gun show loophole, there's a lot of new laws, like I mentioned, Robin Anderson's bill making it illegal to transfer firearms to minors without background checks. Police training has also changed from just containing the perimeter to immediate engagement during an active shooter situation. But there's also the darker legacy of it all. Who's to say that the copycat effect, right? There's a lot of massacres that are inspired numerous plots and attacks that have been worldwide. The FBI now actively tracks threats like referencing Columbine and pushes for earlier intervention, which I think it was years later. I forgot what year it was, where it was in Aurora, Colorado.
Yeah.
The movie, the movie shooting.
Yep.
Yes.
The during, Joker guy.
Yes. The Dark Knight. Mm-hmm. Years later, that takes place too. I forgot what year it is, but that also takes place there, which is so dark because it just all goes hand in hand now. The families of Eric and Dylan have lived with a very different kind of aftermath. You know, they lost their sons as well, but also they were having to confront the knowledge that their sons were the ones that were responsible for the deaths and trauma of so many. Yeah. And in the days and years after the shooting, they were all grieving very privately, kind of shielded from public view due to a lot of safety concerns, of course,
100%.
And the backlash that they were getting. Now, what I saw about Eric's family is that they've kind of pretty much mostly remained silent since it happened. And in 2004, Eric's family, the Harris family, they released a brief statement expressing a lot of deep sorrow for the victims and the survivors. They have never given an on-camera interview, or any legal settlements were reached because of the victims' families, or all that was done confidently and quietly.
Mm-hmm.
Their privacy kind of, some people have speculated, you know, but those who have met them describe the two parents as devastated as any other parent would be, living with a burden that they'll never, ever be able to shake. Which, again, like I said, you can't, you know, you were saying it too. You just can't easily be like, oh, it was the parents' fault. It could, they could have been living in the most loving household. We don't know.
Yeah. I mean, again, how many, because you have, there's been shooters too that have siblings.
Yeah.
Their siblings weren't shooters.
Which apparently Eric had a sibling, had a younger, I think it was a younger brother.
That's interesting. Yes. But if that's true, same thing. That kind of goes to the point to me.
Right. If one, why not the other?
Yeah.
Yes.
And also, if it's the family, if it's the household, why isn't there random concerns about the father at his job or the mother at her job?
That's what I mean. Again, yeah. It's so complex.
There's a lot of things that can go into it.
Yeah, very true. And for Dylan's parents, Tom and Sue, like I said, Sue's been very public about, you know, just kind of, that's how she says she grieves, is a way to just, she kind of grieves outwards, and Tom, her husband, grieves inward. He's just more of a kind of reserved, keeps things to himself. In 2016, she released A Mother's Reckoning, Living with the Aftermath of Tragedy. It was pretty much a memoir detailing her shock, grief, and her understanding how long it took her to understand her son's mental health struggles. She also donates all the proceeds that she makes to mental health and suicide prevention charities. She has since spoken openly in a bunch of interviews. You can really find them anywhere on YouTube. She's done ABC's Diane Sawyer. She's done a TED Talk, My Son Was a Columbine Shooter, This Is My Story. And in her talk, she stresses that she did not see any clear warning signs, but she had since learned to recognize a lot more subtle shifts in behavior that she can kind of signal suicide or violent ideation now. So she's learned a lot, but she's become a big advocate for mental health awareness. She's talked about a lot of open communication and early intervention. She actually works with Connie Sanders, the teacher who passed. She works with her because she's a therapist, because her father passed away. She became a therapist, and she actually helps juveniles who, like Eric and Dylan were, when they got into trouble. And, you know, they have to join the program and do all that stuff. So Sue actually works with Connie. And it's kind of crazy because Connie also opens up in a lot of interviews as well. And she says that it took her and her family a long time, but now she works with Sue. And it's kind of a way, like, how can we help not let this happen again?
Yes.
And it's so difficult for so many to imagine feeling even some sort of remote compassion towards them. But for those who have lost someone to suicide or violence, the complexity must be incredibly heavy. And these families, like, even though they didn't commit the crimes, they still have to live with the knowledge, yes, of what their kids did. And pretty much being condemned from the public.
And I think I'm sure that for Sue, especially knowing how depressed her son was, I think about that time once again. Depression wasn't.
She mentions that. She mentioned that. She's like, knowing what we knew back then. And she says, she's like, I'm not excusing it. Like, he murdered them. He did.
Yes.
Like, I'm not going to deny that. I'm not saying it's an excuse. But she says that she, at the time, it wasn't really.
Mental health wasn't a thing. Yeah. Nobody gave a shit about. Yeah. Like, it was. I don't want to say they didn't give a shit about because we still had therapists, but it was just more, oh, well, you're just sad. You just need to figure out how to be happy. Like, right. You'll be okay.
You also have to think about the stigma back then. If you saw a therapist, man, you're crazy.
Yeah.
You're crazy.
Yes.
So why would I want to? And it's all about the public view and all that. And she even says, she's like, we were getting him help a year prior. He got into trouble and we were
doing everything we could.
We could, right. Yeah. So another piece that I saw was that several victims' family members, including Daryl Scott, which was his father of Rachel Scott and Craig Scott, have expressed a lot of empathy towards the Klebolds and Harrises, recognizing that they too lost their children.
Yeah.
It's so complex because even like Sue, she talks about it. She's like, I grieve for the families, the victims, everyone that was affected. But it's also hard that she also has to grieve. Like, she put a great example to kind of describe her, how she's grieving and how she feels, is she said, imagine walking your dog and he's on a leash, and then your dog goes and starts attacking everybody else. Mm-hmm. And all you're doing is holding the leash, but you can't do anything about it. You're just watching him attack everybody else. So it's like, she feels like there was, so it's just heavy. It's very heavy, but the tragedy of Columbine reached into pretty much every home. Like, look at us.
Yeah.
So at the end of this massacre, 13 lives were taken. 12 students, one teacher, 24 individuals were injured. I mean, countless of other victims as well who were just there that day, the trauma that must hold. Now, again, I'm sorry. It's another two-parter. I just left you guys off at a two-parter, but bear with us, okay?
I give full, on behalf of the listeners and knowing what we're covering,
yes,
I give full approval for this being a two-parter just because of how heavy it is. Not saying none of the other cases deserve this in depth.
Right, but right.
For something like this that has the magnitude behind it, 100%.
Yeah, I don't want to rush anything. And I also want to I want to remember all the lives that were lost and those who were affected, that I could find a space and the time to be able to tell their stories as well. And just remember them from who they are. So you'll definitely be hearing a lot more of that next week. And a lot more about Columbine in itself, you know?
Yeah. So
stay tuned, guys. Next week. We'll see you next week. Thank you guys so much. And thank you so much again for all the well wishes. You guys are honestly the best. We love you so, 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 so much. And thank you again from the bottom of our hearts. We love you guys. Thank you for joining us today on Macabre Mondays. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. You can find us wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you know more about today's episode or caught a detail we might have missed, let us know.
What up? We'd love to hear from you. Again, I say this every time. If you have a story that's strange, sinister, or downright spooky, or, in the case of today's episode, something that you just want us to fucking cover, send it in. You can email us at macabremondayspodcast@gmail.com or head over to macabremondays.com to submit your story. Yours just might be featured in an upcoming listener episode.
Follow us on social media by searching Macabre Mondays for photos of today's episode, updates, and a little extra spooky fun. We'll see you next Monday for another sinister, strange, and spooky episode. Stay tuned. More mystery is just around the corner. But until then, stay curious and stay safe. Bye,
peace
everyone.
Up, Baytown.
Forget everything you had planned for this weekend because you are sitting on your couch and winning from the comfort of your own home. I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play hundreds of slot games, all of the table games you love, and you could even win real cash prizes. New users, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.